You know, we've dealt with the story again and again and again over the years. I remember when we talked about it in 91 during Gulf War One. We talked about it after the war on the Balkans. And now we have to return to it again because of rising concerns and agitations about the health effects of DU weapons in Gulf War Two. It's used, DU as it's known, is used widely to make bullets and shells and bombs capable of piercing armoured vehicles and fortified buildings. It's used by several countries, though not, I'm pleased to say, by Australia, because of its unique armour-piercing ability. And many thousands of DU weapons were used back in 91 in the former Yugoslavia and even more in Iraq this year. No doubting their effectiveness as weapons, but there's an unanswered question that's been hanging around for over a decade. What impact does exposure to DU have on soldiers and civilians in the longer term in war zones? Now, there are many veterans, American, British, Canadian, Australian, who believe that DU is at least partly responsible for their subsequent illnesses, like Gulf War syndrome, for example. But the jury is very much out on the long-term health effects. The US and British military both cite a lack of scientific evidence, although the Ministry of Defence is offering urine tests for soldiers returning from the Middle East. So just what do we know about the dangers, or otherwise, of depleted uranium? With us in London is Professor Brian Spratt. As I said earlier, no one knows more about this than Brian. He's from the Department of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at the Faculty of Medicine, Imperial College London. And Brian is chairman of the Royal Society's Working Group on DU, which has done a most extensive independent study of the health effects. In our Melbourne studio, Doug Rockey. Doug's a former US Army physicist who led a team in the 1991 Gulf War to clean up American tanks hit by friendly fire DU weapons. Doug has since quit the US Army, and he now campaigns against depleted uranium, and he's on a speaking tour of Australia at the moment. Gentlemen, I welcome you both. Brian Spratt, just how significant is the move by the British Ministry of Defence to offer tests to soldiers returning from Iraq? Is it just to calm them down?
Well, I think it shows that the Minister of Defence in the UK is at least taking the issue seriously, which is a very, very different attitude to the American military, who seem not to be interested in having any tests for their soldiers. So I think it's a significant move, and I think one of the big problems in the whole DU arena is that we're talking about the health consequences of DU when we don't actually know what the exposures are on the battlefield.
So you endorse this because it gives you something for your database, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that's really what we need is to get an idea for soldiers and also for civilians, because there may well be quite substantial exposure of civilians in the recent conflict. So I think we want to get some real data of what the intakes are across the battlefield, what the intakes of DU are for civilians, and then we can actually start arguing about what those intakes mean in terms of health consequences.
Now, Brian, were there any studies like this conducted in Gulf War One or in Yugoslavia?
I mean, there were almost no studies of the intakes of DU from those scenarios, and I think that's very unfortunate. The Ministry of Defence in the UK has a programme to actually measure the levels of depleted uranium in the urine of soldiers from the 1991 Gulf War. So there is a programme up and running to try and actually work out what the intakes were in 1991 from the current excretion of DU in urine, but that's not easy to do.
Brian, given that there's something still to be found from urine after exposure 10 years or more ago, does that mean it's urgent to conduct the tests on Gulf War II?
I think it is important because we're talking about a substance which is radioactive. It's not very radioactive, but it's fairly weakly radioactive, but it's also chemically toxic. And I think if you're going to use hundreds of tons of this material in modern warfare, it's really not fair on soldiers and civilians if you don't know what the intakes of that material are and therefore what the health risks are. So I think it's absolutely crucial to get some real information from the current conflict.
So it's fair to say at the moment that we don't know much about DU.
Well, I think we can make estimates of what the intakes are, and I think it's probably fair to say for most soldiers on the battlefield, the intakes would be pretty low, and the health consequences would be almost nil. So we're particularly worried about people who might be heavily exposed, either because they were in a vehicle struck by a DU round, or they were cleaning up tanks, things like that.
Well, that's a good place to bring Doug in, because that's what the situation Doug was in. Doug, you've had first-hand experience with the effect of depleted uranium weapons, or the explosive effect. What makes them different from non-DU weapons in terms of the physical damage done to, say, a tank?
Well, when the uranium round impacts, and I both had the responsibility to clean it up during the Gulf War, and then I was the director of the depleted uranium project for the U.S. Department of Defense in 94 and 95, so I did all the testing on the Nevada test site. What happens and what we found and confirmed in our testing is when a DU round hits, and first off, we have to understand that each individual Abrams tank round is over 4,700 grams of solid uranium, and each individual round fired from the A-10 is over 300 grams of solid uranium. When it's fired from the gun tube of the tank or the aircraft, it's encased in a sabot. That sabot falls away immediately as soon as it leaves the tube of the gun. And then the uranium round catches fire, and on impact, it breaks up in fragments. The testing that we conducted, we saw during Gulf War I, what I conducted in the Nevada test site in 94 and 95, we verified about 30 to 40, maybe 50% of the round disintegrated on impact. And as a consequence, we had spalling. When we looked at the spalling sizes ranged everywhere from large pieces down to submicron components. And as a consequence, we found extensive contamination. When I did the testing in Nevada in 94 and 95, we'd shot a round into a vehicle that was totally clean, no explosives, so all I had was the round on impact. And we saw such a large concentration of uranium left within the tank that you physically couldn't see very far across the tank. So we're looking at approximately 2,000 grams per individual round in an area of approximately 100 cubic feet.
Now,
that's
Doug,
an unbelievable concentration.
What kind of protection did you use, or were you expected to use, during your cleanup work?
We used HEPA filter gas masks and respirators that were issued by the military. And however, what we found both in Gulf War I and then when we did the Nevada test is even when we're wearing the full respirators, that you could taste and smell the burnt uranium. It's got a very distinctive taste and aroma. And when I talked to some of the senior scientists that were the particle experts from the Manhattan Project, who's still alive, and thank God for helping us, they said it's been known since the 1940s the particulates that are formed during these type of detonations go down as small as 0.1 micron. That explains why it went right through the HEPA filter masks and why, in my own case, my absolute verified documented dose of uranium that it was excreting from the urine was so high.
Mm. Brian, the widely accepted figure for the amount of DU fired into Iraq in the first Gulf War was 340 tons. And now figures are being bandied out of between 1,000 and 2,000 tons in Gulf War II. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean, I think we need some clarity here. I mean, the UK military have produced a figure of how much DU that they use, which was 1.9 tons. But the US are not releasing the figure that they used. The amount the US will have used will be, well, certainly in the Gulf War, it was 300 times more than the amount the UK used, because the most of the DU is used from aircraft, and it's only the US that used the DU rounds in aircraft.
That's incorrect.
So we would expect that there would be probably more than in the first Gulf War, 1991. So I think a figure of 500 tons would not be unreasonable. The larger figures, I think, are because people have speculated that new types of bunker busting devices were used.
Well, they're said to carry several tons, aren't they?
Now, yeah, but that hasn't really been verified. But I think we need some clarity. We really need the U.S. to come out and say how much DU was used, where it was used, particularly in residential areas, and also if there were any new weapons used that contain large amounts of DU.
Doug Rocky, are we going to get that clarity, that specificity from the U.S. military?
I have specifically called numerous times because I concur with Brian on the 500 tons based on the knowledge that I have and the discussions I've had. So we're both in agreement on that. I've specifically have asked the U.S. Army Central Command numerous times, could you identify exactly how much was used? I've also asked Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, who's Deputy Secretary of Defense, in charge of this, how much was used, and they've never responded. At the same time, when we finished Gulf War I, I was a health physicist along with the other physicians on site that issued the directive for medical care for all individuals who were exposed. That was issued immediately with the completion of Gulf War I and the ground campaign, and then the medical directive was issued fully in June, and then in October of 1993, when we were getting ready to use the uranium munitions in Somalia, we got a very specific directive issued identifying what type of exposures require an assessment. And as Brian has said, he's absolutely right. Even though we had 424 individuals with absolutely high levels exposures, as verified by Dr. Kilpatrick's staff, as of the year 2000, there was only 51 of us had ever received medical care.
I want to come back to medical matters as they apply to you, Doug, in just a minute, because there's a story to be told. But Brian Spratt, the U.S. government says that its earlier studies, including one in 1990, suggested depleted uranium may, quote-unquote, pose a risk to soldiers and civilians, but that's now out of date, and they say there's no solid scientific evidence to support a connection between exposure to DU and long-term health problems. Would you agree with that rather sanguine view?
Well, I think there is absolutely no doubt that if you inhale large enough amounts of DU particulates, there is a clear risk to health, particularly a risk of lung cancer. And if you haven't actually measured what the intakes were on the battlefield, either in soldiers surviving in a struck tank or just the general soldiers on the battlefield, it's very hard to make any clear-cut statements of the type that the U.S. military have been making. So I don't agree with them. I think they should take the matter more seriously. And we don't think that, you know, for most soldiers on the battlefield there is a problem, but there are categories of soldiers where there may be very significant risks.
Well, let's look at one category. That's Doug Rocky himself. Now, tell us about your own sickness. I understand your symptoms involve breathing problems, fluid in the lungs, loss of fine motor control, kidney problems.
That is correct. While we were cleaning it up during Gulf War I, and again when we did the research in Nevada in 94-95, my primary dose was inhalation. And again, my other team member's primary dose was inhalation. What did happen to us, confirmed by our medical records, is that within 48 to 72 hours of our initial exposures as a DU cleanup team, all of us started developing the respiratory problems, and we just started developing the rashes. The first cancers developed in our team members within 9 months after they returned, and that was thoracic up in the upper breathing passages in the nasal pharyngeal area. And then the first lung cancers developed where they were detected by Dr. Asa Durakovich, who was actually a U.S. Army colonel, within about 2 years, and the deaths have continued up to the present.
Now, Brian, would this story of Doug's be consistent with what you call extreme conditions?
Well, again, we don't know what the intakes were, but certainly if you were going in and out of struck tanks, cleaning them up without adequate respiratory protection, you might get quite heavily exposed. I mean, we actually, in one of our Royal Society reports, commented on Doug Rocky's group, and we did actually make a suggestion that his claims about the health of his comrades should actually be looked into.
Brian, I'm very concerned with the anecdotal stuff that I've been bombarded with by listeners, some of whom have got scientific credentials, about the potential problems and indeed claims of existing, current, immediate problems in Iraq with civilians. This stuff hangs around a fairly long time. It can get into the water table, presumably. It can get into the food chain.
Yes, I think that's another aspect. We have the inhalation, which is one concern. The other concern is that about 80% of the DU which is used, which might be 400 tons, for example, of DU in the recent conflict, will end up being embedded in the soil. And that DU will corrode, and some of that DU may find its way into local water supplies, particularly into wells. And so where large amounts of DU have been used in residential areas, we think it's important that the local water supplies are monitored for increases in the levels of uranium. And that's another reason why we want the Americans to tell us where DU was actually used, particularly in residential areas.
Brian, Doug's not getting much response from them. Are you getting a better hearing?
Well, it's the Royal Society is an independent organisation, and we can make requests for information from the UK government. It's much more difficult to find the appropriate mechanism to make requests of the American government.
Doug, you've been in Australia talking to various medical and returned services groups. What kind of interest is there? What kind of response are you getting?
It's been substantial. I did meet with the RSL in Australia, and they're very concerned. And again, for the, you know, when we have the individuals, and Brian's right with the different categories with exposures as to the amount they're going to get in. And again, one thing I want to repeat, and again, the same thing was absolutely measured by me, by the U.S. Department of Energy, not by the Department of Defense. Based on inhalation dose, they measured my excretion rate at over 432 micrograms of uranium per liter of urine, some 3 years after the fact, which was astronomical. Although we have continued to request assessment on the DU team and on the friendly fire casualties, I've still been unsuccessful in getting the medical care or the assessments done in the United States. To date, as Dr. Kilpatrick and Colonel McNaughton has said, they're given medical care to about 70. That doesn't even represent half the friendly fire that we're exposed. Brian and I totally agree. We have to identify where it was used. We have to conduct the testing. And that what we have to do is look at the physiological effects.
Given we've looked at them
a long time, we have a real problem.
Given the inconclusive evidence so far, Brian, is it reasonable to keep on using DU in weapons until there is more conclusive evidence one way or another? Or should caution be uppermost and such weapons be withdrawn from use? At least until we know.
I'm speaking on behalf of the Royal Society, which is an independent scientific organisation, and I don't want to get involved in the politics of this. I think the important thing is to find out what the facts are, what the exposures are, what the risks are, and then put that body of evidence to government, and they have to make decisions.
But it is, of course, intensely political, isn't it? You can't avoid being embroiled.
It's intensely political on two sides. I mean, there is the military, who want to say that DU is safe because they want to continue using it, and there are other groups who are getting involved in the act because DU is radioactive, and there's a large anti-nuclear lobby who wants to over-inflate the risk. So it's political on both sides.
Acknowledged.
I think our job is to cut through and try and find out as much as possible what the real facts are.
One of the things that I have a very concern with is the fact that what we're doing is taking uranium radioactive waste as a part, it's the remainder, 99% of the waste from the uranium enrichment process, and we also know that it has been contaminated through the enrichment process and recycling. And we're just taking hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands of tons of solid uranium, where in the United States, Australia, Great Britain, any country, you can't even take 1 kilogram of this stuff and throw it into a park, into a schoolyard, into a residential neighborhood, and yet we have deliberately and willfully spread hundreds and thousands of tons, a thousand tons of this stuff around nations. And even though, as the director of the DU project, we specifically wrote the cleanup procedures, which have adopted by NATO, they are willing, just deliberately, willfully ignoring those cleanup requirements, and they're also deliberately willingly ignoring the medical assessment that Brian and I totally agree needs to be done.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it?
Completely.
The WMDs, the weapons of mass destruction, are missing in action, but the DU weapons are alive and kicking, and we don't know much about them. Gentlemen, I thank you very much. Professor Brian Spratt, Chairman of the Royal Society's Working Group on DU, speaking from London. And in Melbourne, Doug Rocking, a former US Army physicist who's now not in the best state of health and is campaigning against this category of weapon. This is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web.